So good evening, everyone. And the reason for sitting in a chair, which is pretty unusual for me, is that on Wednesday I had bilateral hernia surgery. So I'm a little bit sore. And sitting in the chair helps. So pretty comfortable this way too. So this evening I want to tell you a story. And then with some vague idea that once I tell the story that we'll do something participatory where you have a chance to kind of somehow engage the story. We'll see, you know, as we go along what makes sense. The story I want to tell you is in Theravadan Buddhist countries, in the countries where Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, countries like that. This is the second most popular Buddhist story. And most people in the West don't know this story. People who know about Buddhism in the West will know the number one most popular story, which is a story having to do with the Buddha's life, his enlightenment and things like that. And the second most popular story is one which is certainly a Buddhist story. It is a story of, in the traditional kind of idea, there are many lifetimes of preparation that went into becoming a Buddha. And so there are past lives and these stories about what this person who eventually became the Buddha, stories of what his past lives were like. And this is a story of his penultimate life before he became a Buddha. So the last lifetime before he became a Buddha. And what I've read in studies of Theravada Buddhism is that when this story is told, which is told in all kinds of ways, very popular story to recite, and imagine villagers and people, all kinds of people gathering together at temples, and it's a full moon, it's candles, and they're all huddled together, and very warm, friendly environment, and they're told this wonderful story, this story that moves people very deeply, and in some ways maybe troubles them deeply as well, even though it's a popular story. And it's said that at certain points in the story, many people are often crying, kind of very moved by it. So hearing this as the background, as you hear the story, be slow to dismiss it as myth. Be slow to dismiss it as being simplistic. Because I think that somehow it, for a whole population of Buddhists, it speaks to something very profound in their lives. And I would suggest maybe something a little bit troubling them, some difficulty in their lives, something that's it's not necessarily kind of a like the Buddha's enlightenment story. It's kind of like this wonderful progress, right? You know, has a good result, and this one has a good result as well, in kind of fable kind of way. But there's something troubling about this story as well, and it's a troubling aspect of the story, which perhaps points to something deep in our humanity, some deep sense of what it means to be a human being, the trouble of being a human being, the paradoxes, the existential difficulties. Something, perhaps. So the story has to do with a prince named Visantara. And Visantara, so this is the last lifetime before he became a Buddha, he was born as a prince. And as soon as he was able to, as a baby or young toddler or something, it was noticed that he had a tendency towards dana, tendency towards giving things away. And he would give his toys away, whatever he could, he kind of gave away. And this virtue or this habit or this vice continued as he grew up. And he kept giving things away. This is what his tendency was, his disposition. And at some point, he started giving away things which were not his. And the second precept says, do not take what is not given. And perhaps we should add to it, also don't give what is not given. So he started, and at some point as an adult, he was married and had two children, still a prince. The neighboring country had a drought. And his country owned a royal white elephant. White elephants are quite symbolically important in that part of the world. And this white elephant somehow had the ability to produce rain, make rain, a rain-producing elephant. So he heard about the neighboring country having a drought. So he gave the neighboring country his country's white elephant. It wasn't his to give away. It belonged to the country. So the people of the country by this time were quite upset, maybe quite upset with the history of how he behaved and all this generosity, which maybe was a little bit not so wise, perhaps, or something. But he'd given away something that didn't belong to him, belonged to the country. And perhaps, you know, the people in this country who sometimes get blamed for using up resources that belong to the nation, not just to an individual. And so then the people insisted he had to be exiled. And so the king felt obligated and he exiled his son. And his son set off with his family and his two children in a chariot to go beyond the boundaries, borders of the country. And on the way, they met someone who asked him for his chariot. And since he was into generosity, if someone asks, he says, sure, you can have it. And so then his wife and children, him, continued on foot. And they came to some other, beyond the boundaries of the country, and they came to some forest, jungle area, where they were able to build a very simple hut in the jungles, and then continued living there in a very simple life of kind of village, of kind of forest hermits or forest dwellers. And then there was a Brahmin, as the story says, who learned about Visantara and his generosity. And this Brahmin, I guess, was not a very good person. So he went to Visantara and he asked him if he could have his children. And Visantara said, here. So this is when the story starts getting troubling, right? Mm-hmm. And then when his wife came back, she was off that particular day, maybe collecting mangoes or something. And when she came back, where's the children? He explained that someone had asked for them and he felt, you know, his generosity had given his children away to be of service to this, or servants to this Brahmin. And then it's a little bit hazy in my mind exactly how the story goes, but I think it goes something like this, that Brahma, who's the great Zeus of the Indian pantheon, when someone does something exceptional, his throne heats up. And so his throne heated up, and so he went to, what's going on? So he went to check it out. And he saw that, oh, Visantara is giving away his children. This is quite something. His generosity knows no bounds. I'll go down and test him. And so the Brahma kind of transformed himself from a god into some person and went to Visantara and said, I would like to have your wife. And Visantara says, here. At this point, the story has kind of a, in my mind, kind of an unrealistic fairy tale kind of ending. And the ending is that, you know, the god Brahma is coming to test Visantara to see, you know, how far is he really going to go? And when he sees that Visantara is even willing to give away his wife, then he kind of passes the test. And so Brahma, who's this great god, then kind of writes everything, brings the children and the wife back. The family gets reunited. Brahma takes Visantara and his family back to the original kingdom, where he gets received and eventually becomes king, and they live a happily ever after. So that's kind of a strange ending for a strange story. It makes everything okay, right? So there are two primary interpretations of the story that I have. And maybe some of you have different one. The classic one is that in order to become a Buddha, in order to become fully enlightened, a person has to perfect the quality of generosity. Has to bring one's generosity to the level of perfection. And so here he's done that. This is supposed to be an example of that. And so he's kind of managed to bring it to perfection, so he's ready in the next lifetime to become a Buddha. I find this interpretation very unsatisfying, myself. Another one, that's a little bit connected to that first, is that maybe it's all symbolic. You know, it's not really his kids and his wife. But in order to become fully liberated and freed, there has to be a letting go of that which is most precious to us, that we're still holding on to. And that could be our wife and kids. It could be all kinds of things, but not necessarily literally. You don't give them away to someone, your kids, right? But there's some kind of, in order to become free, there's some way in which your heart has to become, not be clinging or bound in bondage to your family, to your community, to your country, to your bank account, to your home, to your, you know, to yourself even, your self-identity, your self-image, to your hopes, to your fears, to your wounds, your hurts. And so there's something very deep that has to be let go of. And it's kind of beautiful in the sense to talk about letting it, giving it away. Kind of that's an act of generosity to yourself and to the world. It has to be this deep giving away or letting go of something. So I find that interpretation a little bit more satisfying because I believe that's the case. And the famous kind of Zen saying, if you meet the Buddha, kill him. I think it points to the idea that even something as sacred as the Buddha, something so important for Buddhists as the Buddha, you can't even hold on to that. There has to be a complete letting go for the mind to be set free. So some people like to say that Buddhism is a self-destructing religion. Because, you know, you do it, and the whole point of it is so you can get over it. So, let go of that, even that. So, now there's another interpretation. And this is the one for me which has the most personal meaning. And so I don't know how it'll be for you. And I've never heard anybody else come up with this interpretation, so it's maybe idiosyncratic. It doesn't have a Buddhist stamp of approval. But this is that in order to become free, in order to become enlightened, in order to become spiritually mature, or mature as a human being, to have developed the level of compassion that's necessary to attain full freedom, like a Buddha, a person needs to make a really bad mistake. And this is what the story is about. He made a really terrible choice. He did something really wrong. You don't do this. You don't give away your children and your wife. Those of us in the psychologically sophisticated West, or at least in the post-Freudian West, can have a sense of the tremendous trauma that something like that could do to children and everyone involved. And I think in the classic story, Vishantara doesn't just do it kind of, you know, casually. He's troubled as well by what he's done. And as people in Thailand listen to this story, they're deeply troubled by this story. But it's a very important story for those people, but they're troubled by this. So what is it about making a big mistake? None of you, of course, have made any mistakes, so. But what is it about making a big mistake? Or what can happen? Or how is it that a big mistake can give birth to compassion, or deepening compassion, or bring compassion to maturity? That's the question. certainly possible to make a big mistake in one's life and deny it. It's possible to justify it. It's possible to put up defenses. It's possible to blame other people for it. I read once that when they did a survey of prisoners in California, California jails, they asked them a simple question, why are you in jail? And the vast majority of them blamed someone else besides themselves. The lawyers, the judge, the police. Now, maybe there are people in California jails who are innocent, shouldn't be there. But my guess is it's not the vast majority. So this tendency of blaming someone else rather than looking, what did I do? Taking responsibility for oneself. So to take responsibility for one's own actions, really to allow oneself to feel and sense and experience one's mistake. To allow it somehow to really be felt in the heart. To let the heart be broken, maybe. I've told the story a lot, but I like it so much, so you'll forgive me. There's a story of, it's a Jewish story, of a yeshiva, Jewish school, where they had a sign on the wall in the classroom that said, in this school, we place the teachings on the heart. And some student asked the teacher at some point, why do you put the teachings on the heart? Why don't you put it in the heart? And the teacher says, oh, only God can do that. We can only put them on your heart, and when the hearts break, the teachings fall in. So, to simply say that we should learn from mistakes is too crass, I think. But to allow ourselves to be transformed, to really feel deeply, and take responsibility for what we've done, and not to kind of get over it quickly. I love I'm very fond of what I know about the 12-step program, the recovery program, the big book. I don't know so much about it, but what I know about it, I just think it's really, really a wise system. And there, a really important part of that program is to make a moral inventory. And people will spend, a long time, often I think writing, and often it has to be done in the presence of someone else. It's one thing to start by yourself, but it's one thing to kind of, be alone. Oh, I know I did this terrible thing. I really know that. And I'll do better in the future. It's a whole different thing to go find someone and tell them. The process that the heart and the mind goes through is very different if it's kind of told someone else. So in recovery, they make a moral inventory and say this, and they go back. And some people are quite surprised to go back over their lifetime and realize, wow, I had no idea there was so much. I had no idea there was these patterns. Somehow take ownership or understanding or allow these things to kind of have their full impact on us. And I think this way, this approach, which I think is an approach of mindfulness as well, we allow ourselves to really be present fully for what our experience is one that has a lot of respect for the natural, maybe transformative process of the human heart. That the human heart is something that the human mind, the human psyche, some circles they say the human soul, has its own laws or its own process, its own kind of way of moving towards freedom, to release, towards compassion, to love, if it's given the chance. And to really stop and really fully experience and feel what our life is allows for that inner process to unfold if we don't interfere with it. And so to have a really big mistake and then to really stop for it, to be mindful of it, and really allow it to kind of, don't be in a hurry to get over it, or don't be in a hurry to ignore it or to get on with life. But to allow that natural process to kind of really take it in and allow some real careful attention to be given to it. In the Theravadan monastic world, there are all these precepts that rules that the monastics have to follow. And there's some of them are minor and some of them are pretty grave when they're broken. And depending on the severity of the rule that's broken, there are different ways in which a person then comes back into harmony with themselves and the community. And some of them are not quick. Some of them require taking time to kind of be, you know, be kind of a little bit kind of put on the edge of the community for a while. And sometimes letting other people know what you've done. One friend of mine who was a monk broke a rule, and he was required, I think, for a week or something, to stand at the entrance of the monastery. And every time a monk who didn't know the story came into the monastery, he had to tell his story. And of course, initially, he was quite embarrassed. But with time, he realized this was really wise. And one of the things that happened was that a lot of these monks who came said, "Oh, I did that once too." You know, and the people were, a lot of the monks, they weren't judgmental. They were kind of like, "Oh, okay, that's how it is." And I think in recovery work as well, I think in a good process is you share your moral inventory with someone. And sometimes it's the same thing. So, "Oh, yeah." Maybe the first person's embarrassed or whatever, ashamed. "Oh, yeah. It's like that for me too." So our shared humanity. And I think this is important, you know, and the story of Vicentara, from this perspective of having made a big mistake, I see as a great antidote to one of the difficulties in Buddhist teachings. And that is, Buddhist teachings tends to focus on human perfection. The idea that becoming a Buddha, becoming enlightened, is moving to kind of a level of certain kind of human perfection. Inner perfection of purification. And I think it's very different, I believe, from like often Western theology or religion, where the idea of perfection is not really, human perfection is not really the goal exactly. But the idea of human perfection then, that is an ideal, sometimes it gets very easy to overlook or to dismiss the messiness of being a human being. And the story of Vicentara, as I like to interpret it, you know, points to the kind of difficulties of being a human being, the messiness and the struggles. And of course, this is how it is. We don't want to justify it. We don't want to kind of condone the mistakes we make. But is there some way of having some wide compassion, care, a certain kind of acceptance, certain kind of, "Oh, yes, that's how it is. I've done that too." Not to judge people and say, "Oh, you're a terrible person because of that." But rather they come and tell you what they've done. They said, "Oh, welcome to humanity." And then let's see. It's, you know, I have tremendous respect for the power of mindfulness. And the collective mindfulness of being honest and sharing with other people is very, very, I think, very helpful. So what do you think of this story? I've shared my interpretation. Do you have any comments or your own interpretations, or what would you like to do here? Yes?
One of the things that's very odd to me about this story is that the Brahma, I think you said it was the Brahman god, comes down and fixes things. Which is very odd to me, because, you know, in my mind, when I have made mistakes, one of the difficult but most helpful lessons is to develop the humility to live with it, mm-hmm. and to make amends as best as possible.
Yes, and that's kind of what I was trying to, my interpretation is trying to say as well. So. I mean, in a classic interpretation of the story, it makes some sense, because in the classic interpretation, he's being very virtuous. And he's being rewarded for his virtue. To be everything being reinstated. That's the logic. If the origins of the story are more like my interpretation, then then perhaps the ending of the story is a cop-out.
Is there another
or another way of it is that the ending of the story being fable-like is symbolic for the healing that can happen when you really kind of are really present for your life in a full, compassionate way. And so perhaps you know, in the story, Visantara himself was troubled by what he had done. And so perhaps there's a way in which that being troubled and opening to that allowed for something deeper to happen within himself, and some kind of healing, some kind of opening, some kind of maturing. And then this kind of symbolic ending was one that kind of in a mythic way or fable way of saying, yes, when you do that, then things come back into harmony.
Does the story indicate that he was troubled?
That's my understanding, my memory. It's been long, many years since I read it, but my memory of the story is he's troubled by what he's done. Yes?
Well, I guess you could say also, continuing on from your interpretation, that when he had gotten back his family, that then he did have something to contend with concerning his decision, because after all, they weren't consulted.
Yeah.
I mean, he took them as possessions that he was able to give away without respect for them as, you know, individuals, entities, and also how it may have appeared that he didn't love them, that he could just give them away, that he didn't care enough for them, and so on and so forth. All the things that, you know, he would then have to contend with in terms of confronting the fact that it was a mistake. If you look at the story in that regard, then the lesson would be, would follow. I mean, it isn't just now everything is okay because the family is back. Anyway, that's another way of looking at it.
So you know, in along those lines, he was given a second chance, and that second chance wasn't by simply ignoring what he'd done in the past, but that second chance was given to him to kind of try again, in a sense, but with knowing what he'd done and somehow having to contend with that and work with it. But you know, his wife didn't just kind of kick him out of the house and say, "Forget you." But you know, he was given a second chance, and then maybe in that second chance, that kind of generosity, maybe it's her generosity. Maybe it's her generosity allowed him to become a Buddha.
Well, I mean, perhaps whatever age his children are, but children would certainly say, "Well, why did you do that, Dad?
Yeah.
Don't you like us?" Or didn't, or whatever, as any parent would know, or any child would know. We were all once children.
Yeah. Thank you, Jennifer.
It seemed to me to be about the sort of danger of having one perfection without the others. I mean, he obviously had the perfection of generosity without the perfection of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like it's a little unclear whether or not he gained the perfection of wisdom by making this big mistake, but if he did, then that's what seemed to me to be mm-hmm. sort of powerful about the stories, that all 10 are really quite important to be in balance mm-hmm. in order to be actually sort of fully awake.
I think your point as well is good. And then to add to that, in the Theravada tradition, a quality is not a perfection unless it's combined with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's perhaps he didn't, you know, he'd taken generosity to an extreme, but he hadn't joined it with compassion.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, this lesson of compassion, I think many, many people probably find that their compassion for themselves and for others takes a quantum leap after they've kind of been humbled or humiliated, or after they've kind of done something that really, you know, a big mistake. And, you know.
And I guess because of the compassion aspect, I actually like the ending as a symbol of, it's sort of like there is this sort of universal, totally selfless compassion even when no human being in the situation can really rise to the occasion, mm-hmm. there's still this underlying mm-hmm. thing. So.
Great.
You said the... I'm sorry. You said that people get trouble and then they are able to follow or realize what he said a few minutes ago. In our culture, in Hinduism, the spirituality has been taken by many, many saints, as we call them, after they have really, really committed some big blunder. And even in today's world, you will see a lot of beginnings of the spirituality in many human beings. It starts when they make a big blunder or they run into some big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that moral of the story makes a lot of sense to me.
Thank you. I won't ask for testimonials here. Please.
Yes, thank you. When you mentioned compassion a little earlier, and that it had to do with compassion, that it seemed to me that the first thing after your big boo-boo and you see that you did it, or not the first thing, but someplace down the line, is forgiveness of yourself. And you can't forgive somebody else for being a bumblehead or whatever until you've seen the same thing in yourself and forgiven yourself. And even the root of the word forgive is dana, is forth giving. It's instead of clinging to the fault, you give it up, giving up the clinging of that. And it made a lot of sense to do that. My daughter and I were talking today about chocolate, and it wasn't a huge offense. But can you face it and consciously go ahead and get the chocolate and then forgive yourself, but learn why did you need to go get the chocolate? So that's not a very big one.
Wait a minute, that logic of that seems a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
you don't plan ahead.
but I found
it's okay to do this because tomorrow I'm going to forgive myself.
I think there's a wonderful saying, too, that the simplicity of it is the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Mm. Mm, that's nice. Thank you. Yes, Rainbow.
I think I heard this story as a story of redemption, and I wondered if you were giving it around to Easter for a particular reason, or maybe it occurred to me because it's around Easter. But anyway, the idea of redemption and getting a second chance is very moving to me. That aspect that you mentioned toward the end in your version of the story seemed profound in a way, that you sort of eliminate the shame of your experience by coming out around it and having other people's witness to it is another aspect of redemption, that it's not something that comes from above. It is something that comes from sharing the way that we are human on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's what came to me.
Beautiful. Thank you.
The other thing that's really troubling to me is that the story is about giving away life. And it starts out with giving away the life of an animal. And then it changes to giving away the lives of two children. And then it switches to giving away the life of a woman. And, you know, it's kind of like this escalating, escalating mistakes.
Yeah.
And these lives are props, are just props for the story. There's no telling of how these animals or other people dealt with this or felt about it. And I find that very odd. It's,
yeah, yeah.
It's like the story continues the idea of them just being props.
Being impersonal, yeah. So, I mean, it's actually quite a long story or poem. So, you know, it's you know, I told it, it's like, it goes on for hours. So, you know, maybe there's more to it than what I said. And I should go back and read the full-blown story. But, yeah, I agree with you. It's often the case that sometimes certain individuals, both in stories but also in real life, are props, you know, that they're not really seen for who they are or understood for who they are. It's a sad phenomenon.
I'll say this carefully so it doesn't sound like condoning mistakes, but it occurred to me when we were talking about what benefit or things can come out of making mistakes is that even in a mistake there is something given, because we give others the opportunity for forgiveness or for compassion toward us.
Okay, good. But be very careful you're not making mistakes in order to have that.
The other thing that's really troubling to me, this is a very troubling story. The other thing that's very troubling for me is that there is no self-doubt.
In the story, self-doubt by Visantara?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to go back and see. My memory is that he's troubled himself by what he's done. So I don't know if it's doubt, but he himself kind of, you know, feels the gravity of what he's done in the story.
I was wondering, when you were telling the story and in the reactions, if the giving away was a metaphor for releasing clinging. And so, you know, did he literally give the children away and the wife away, or did he just release clinging from them?
Right, that's one way of interpreting the story is that, you know, it's a fable and it's a myth. And it's not to be taken literally, but rather it's pointing to a deep letting go that happens. You know, you can still, you can still, you know, have your car, you know, keep it, take care of it and all that, even though you've let go of your clinging to it. You can still have your family, but you don't, you know, but you let go of the clinging to it. You still have your money, you just don't cling to it. And that's one way of understanding that story. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, sometimes, you know, in spiritual circles, they say things in extreme ways in order to kind of, you know, if you understand this story as being symbolic rather than literal, it's saying what you're pointing to in an extreme way, pointing to the possibility of a very, very powerful, a very significant movement of freedom, of letting go, which is maybe counterintuitive to how we normally operate, which is foreign to how we normally operate. It's very frightening. It's completely, you know, there's normal society doesn't support it or doesn't even understand it. So it can be very, very challenging, and sometimes having a very powerful story or statement, like, you know, kill the Buddha or something, can kind of, oh, I touched something deeper inside of us. So, I'm sorry for those of you who go home troubled. It was not my intention to trouble any of you. My hope, rather than troubling any of you, was to actually, that the story somehow would soften you and soften some part of you that, where you're kind of willing to kind of have a soft opening, maybe acceptance or compassion or kindness or something to yourself, and those parts of yourself, if there are those parts of yourself which trouble you, which you haven't really kind of dealt with, or a softening and opening acceptance in relationship to other people. So rather than being judgmental to others, to realize the difficulty we all share, the difficulties we have, and to be willing to kind of hold other people in your kindness in a soft way. So you go home not troubled, but rather the opposite. Settled, open, softened. I think it's the possibility of this practice to do that. I think with time, mindfulness does that same thing. And... So, that's what you get after surgery.